I love the way that artists think, like the ability to put two things together or to look at something and sketch it or think about something artistically is such an important life skill. So I hope you guys keep thinking of yourselves as artists, no matter what other people call you. Just always call yourself an artist inside, at least.
And Renee, do you have any, do you want to give us ways to find you and more information about your work online for listeners of the podcast?
Yeah, people can go to embodiedastrology.com, E-M-B-O-D-I-E-D, astrology. And I put out free horoscopes every month. So if you are into that kind of thing, the ones for Aquarius season just went out. That's January 20th through February 19th. And they are available on iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher and all the other podcast apps.
And then how do people find Roca online?
You can go to our website, which is art-roca.com, or you can go to our Instagram, which is Reynolds Art Show.
Great, thanks.
Thanks for inviting me to be here.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
And welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience produced at a different location every week. Hey, I'm Nick Espinoza of the Deep Dive Radio Show, where we talk about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, broadcasting out of the Chicagoland area on WHIW 101.3 FM.
And we've got a great show for you this week. We're still at home, still recording in the home studio. Obviously, still don't want to infect any other radio hosts or support staff at the radio station. And again, we're all doing our part. But we have a great show. Like I said, we are going to be obviously catching up on the news and all of that. And I have a very special guest for my deep dive, and that is Paul Walsh. And Paul, I apologize. As I was listening to our recorded interview, I realized I called you Paul Walsh, and I am so sorry for that, but it is a great interview. This guy is brilliant, and he was at the foundation of what we know as the World Wide Web and the Internet, coming right off the heels of Tim Berners-Lee. So it's going to be a great interview. Stick around, and as always, let's start with the news. And this news is actually, I find, rather interesting. It's coming from a couple of different sources, including the Houston Chronicle and the Associated Press. And I think this is actually indicative of what we have as a nationwide issue here in the United States. Now, if you are basically listening to this, you have internet, odds are, in your home, or maybe just obviously the radio as we are sitting here on radio. But many people rely on school or work or libraries for actual internet connections. But what happens when your kids need the internet to continue their education while we're all at home? What happens if you need it for your work? And that's what we're talking about. And this first bit of news comes from the Houston Chronicle here, because a massive number of Houston area students, likely exceeding 100,000, lack broadband internet at home during the coronavirus shutdown, meaning they have a very serious problem when they are trying to access those materials they need to basically perform at school. We are all moving to e-learning, or rather our kids are, and college, if you're listening to this in college. And so here we are. That's actually a very serious issue, as well as a disparity. Now, I find Houston to be very interesting, because depending on the year or so, Houston is either the third or fourth largest city in the United States, either behind or in front of Chicago, where, you know, I'm based out of. And we are also seeing that other major urban areas, like the bigger ones than those two, like Los Angeles and New York, also have this problem as well. But we have a lot of low income, basically pockets throughout the United States that have a very serious issue with actually trying to get broadband. And that is a very serious problem when we can't go to work or school or a library. Now, the districts in Houston have received thousands of hotspots. That's that little device that you'd get from a mobile carrier that basically gives you wireless internet. But the need for connectivity is outpacing the availability for these devices. Now, two officials that have been deeply involved in attempting to buy hotspots for the Houston School District, which is their chief technology officer, as well as the president for the 1 Million Project Foundation, which is a nonprofit that provides free hotspots and internet service to school districts, said that lower grade devices can be obtained in about a month, while higher quality hotspots take about 3 to 4 months to receive. This means that we have a whole swath of students, roughly 100,000 or so in Houston, that are either falling behind their peers or simply can't get access to technology that they need to actually continue. And this actually dovetails with the Associated Press article that just came out alongside the Houston Chronicle article. And that article is entitled, "Those Without Broadband Struggle in a Stuck-at-Home Nation." And the example they give is the town of Sandwich, New Hampshire. Now, this is a town of 1,200 and is apparently best known to be the setting for the movie On Golden Pond. And broadband is rather scarce there. You can't stream Netflix. It's very hard to work or study from home. Even their police department has trouble uploading its reports. And now that we're in the middle of the coronavirus and everybody is sheltering in place, that is a very serious problem for the residents of Sandwich, New Hampshire. Now, this is happening for millions, literally in the United States right now. We are taking for granted that not every place in this country has kept pace with the always expanding internet. And while I'm sure there are other organizations, excuse me, not organizations, there are other countries out there that have this exact same problem, the articles that I am addressing here in my research focus purely on the United States. And since my radio show is based in the US, here we are. And so with that, the Associated Press also released a graph of school districts around the area where the percentage of students have no internet, and many don't even have a computer at home. They have been traditionally relying on the school or the library to actually get them internet. And this is something that most of us don't really consider. And a good chunk of you are probably listening to this after the radio broadcast when it gets converted basically into an audio file, uploaded into SoundCloud and all of that. And the people that basically I'm about to talk about here in these various school districts will never hear this show. You know, and that is, I think, a very serious problem. Not that they can't hear this show, but because they don't have the internet to be able to access anything at all in the planet, including this show. So with that, if we're looking at it, the number one district in the United States that has a percentage of no internet clocks in at almost 67%. Just more than two-thirds of that entire school district has no internet at home, and that is the North Harlem Colony Elementary School District in the state of Montana. At 60% is the Stehekin, and I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, Stehekin School District in the state of Washington. Death Valley Unified School Districts in California, followed by one in Texas, and then Minnesota, Montana, Arizona, Arkansas, and Minnesota. At number 10, that would be Lake of the Woods School District in Minnesota, has only basically 39.7%, basically 40%, 4 in 10 do not have the internet at home. And in terms of computers as well, if we're looking at this, what clocks in at number 6, Trail Creek Elementary School District in Montana, more than a quarter, 26.1%, don't even have a computer at home. This is a huge issue. And I think what the coronavirus or COVID-19 is doing is really showing that there is a massive disparity, a massive gap in the educational system here. But there's also a massive gap in the internet infrastructure. I know that, you know, I live in the Chicagoland area and I can drive a short distance, you know, and basically get into cornfields. And I know that that community, those farming communities, don't have anywhere near what I can get in the greater Chicagoland area with the amount of infrastructure we have. And I think that's a serious problem, and it's something that needs to be addressed. And so with that, that is your news of the day. And I think it's something we all need to address here in America, because if anything, I think it underscores this gap that shouldn't be. The internet is foundational to communication, to education, to business, to everything else. And how is a student going to get ahead if they can't get access to the internet at will? I think that's something we need to discuss as a society, And that's why it's a news article here, or rather a news bit here on this radio show. And so with that, let's move on. And in cyber criminal news, and I found this absolutely fascinating, but countless legitimate businesses are obviously, during this whole mess, offering discounts, or they're altering their services to basically turn a profit to try to survive the coronavirus. And apparently cyber criminals are no different. Now, more than 500 posts on dark web forums were basically tracked by the cybersecurity company Group IB and have been advertising promotional codes and discounts during the coronavirus pandemic on things like denial of service attacks, spam and phishing information, and other cyber criminal services. Now, according to one ad that was discovered on this forum, and this is translated from Russian, this was a Russian ad by cyber criminals, and I quote, "Due to the current situation in the world, we provide a 20% discount on all our services with a promotional code, COVID-2019, until the end of April." Yes, even Russian hackers are discounting their wares basically because of this thing. Now, this doesn't just extend to hacking tools and all that kind of stuff. Stolen credit card data, according to research, has also been marked down, some up to 30 or 40%, depending on the forum. So if you ever wanted to get into cybercrime, now seems like a really good time to start. And obviously, please don't get into cybercrime. But apparently, as we have seen an explosion, in fake phishing websites and all of that, and the COVID-19 Cyber Threat Coalition has been monitoring that, you know, nonstop and continuously as we've been gathering this information, the other kinds of services out there that basically send you phishing emails or try to get you to go to bad websites or even have your stolen credit card there where somebody can buy it and try to use it are all running discounts. Apparently, we're all in this together, good guys and bad guys alike. And so with that, I thought that was very interesting. And that is your cyber criminal news of the week.
And now for the deep dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a deep dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP. Again, that's Nick A. ESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin.
Hey guys, Nick Espinoza, your chief security fanatic here. And today I am joined by a rather fascinating guest. And I think you guys are going to really enjoy this. His name is Paul Wash, and he is from a company called MetaCert. And we were talking just before this interview, and he was telling me some of his backstory that I think is absolutely amazing. And we're going to dive into a couple of different things here. But Paul, thank you so much for joining me here, you know, on the radio, video, and podcast form.
It's a pleasure, Nick. Thanks. And thanks for such a wonderful introduction as well.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Now, I'd love for my audience to hear some of your backstory and also a little bit about what MetaCert does, because I think it's a really fascinating thing.
Backstory, started my tech career at AOL back in the 90s. I was part of the team that helped to launch technologies like AOL Instant Messenger, 56K modem protocol, and a bunch of other cool stuff. Worked in the mobile industry for a while, started my first company in software testing in 2003, was the chairman of the British Interactive Media Association for 3 years when I lived in the UK,
wow,
where I spent 12 years. During that time, around 2003, 2004 to about 2009, I contributed a lot to W3C. So I was the first person to rewrite Tim Berners-Lee's vision of the One Web when I co-founded the Mobile Web Initiative. I'm one of the two people that co-instigated the W3C standard for URL classification in 2004.
Yeah, which for the record, I don't want to interrupt you. For my non-technical audience, can you explain that just a little bit?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So the W3C is the standards body for the World Wide Web, and it creates standards like HTML that most people would be familiar with. And it's responsible for creating other initiatives and standards like the Semantic Web, which I contributed towards also back in the early days. And when I co-founded the Mobile Web Initiative, the web meant something entirely different during the WAP days. And so we really had to rethink what the web was. And that's why I was tasked with rewriting Tim Berners-Lee's vision of the one web, because it meant something entirely different. And so helped to found that initiative. That took about 4 years, and we built, you know, best practices and standards to help developers build websites that work on small phones. But when the iPhone came out, it kind of made that less useful, because it became obvious and easy to see what the web would be on a phone. But in the context of our conversation, I guess the biggest contribution I've had, or that I've made to standards, is I co-founded the standard for URL classification that went on to replace an old standard called PIX, which is what Microsoft Internet Explorer and Apple Parental Controls still use in part today. And then more recently, I founded MetaCert, which is a security company that protects people from dangerous links. So my entire career has brought me to where I am today, which is the web, mobile web, and helping to protect people when they open links.
Yeah, and it's pretty fair to say that since AOL and 56K dial-up, basically nothing has changed in technology. So so you're just doing the same thing over and over and over for the next last 30 years, right?
It's the same thing. And you know, a big part of what I do for a living involves as much about interpreting and foreseeing human behavior around new technologies as it is about the technical side of classification of URLs, or the technical side of browser software, or team collaboration software like Slack and Skype and so on. So yeah, a lot of it is around the human behavior.
Yeah, well, as it has to be. I mean, and that's something that I talk about a lot in my videos and my radio show, is that at the end of the day, humans are the ones interacting. We're the ones that trust. We're the ones using the technology. And if something's going to get us hacked, it's probably going to be ourselves. So, you know, I think that's a very good point. Now, I want to pivot just a little bit here as well, because you're actually involved in something that I'm involved with as well, and that's the COVID-19 Cyber Threat Coalition. And I think we're doing a lot of great work, and I know my listeners and my viewers have heard me talk about this before, but you know, I'd love to get it from your perspective, just given your, you know, your history and coming right off the heels of Tim Berners-Lee, one of the, you know, granddaddies of the World Wide Web. You know, I'd like to know, you know, from your perspective, you know, what do you think of the cyber coalition thus far, the COVID-19 Cyber Threat Coalition, and how we're doing?
I think we're doing a really good job. I think there are two main benefits from the initiative. One is we're all coming together as collaborators. As you know, there's now 3,000 members in this community and growing fast. So by the time you push this content out, it's probably 3,500 or 4,000 people, right? Yeah. And we're a mix of professionals. By that I mean we're professionals in cybersecurity. We have government agencies. So cybersecurity professionals that belong to companies in the space, in security space, but also brands, right? So we have a lot of brands being represented inside the community. So we have brands, security companies, law enforcement, government agencies, and potential customers. And what we're doing is we're putting together, as you know, a central global repository of URLs that are dangerous and are specific to COVID-19. And so I think that's one major benefit, is coming up with that global feed that other companies can make use of to protect their customers and end users. But also, I think the fact that so many of us from around the world are working on COVID-19 specific cyber attacks and scams should help raise awareness amongst those that don't understand or appreciate the significance. The level of fraud and scams on the web right now that are COVID related, whether it's somebody impersonating the World Health Organization with counterfeit websites, or whether it is, you know, pretending to sell masks or pretending to have free tests, it's absolutely insane. It's exploding right now. And there's no, you know, it doesn't look like it's letting up. It's just getting worse and worse. And unfortunately, as you know, people don't realize the importance of security until it's too late. And so we hope to raise awareness as well as provide the tools.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying is absolutely correct. And you know, just I remember about a week ago or so, you know, the coalition was having a conversation about this. I believe it was in one of our meetings where somebody had mentioned, and maybe it was even you, I can't remember, that within a 24-hour period, they had seen basically 60,000 registrations of coronavirus, COVID-19, something related to that. And within 24 hours, there was another 20,000 on top of that. Now, not all of that is going to be malicious. I mean, obviously, there's like government websites and all of that. But you know that there's going to be a huge chunk of that that is going to be malicious, infected, you know, whatever that is. And so I find it very interesting that all this information is being aggregated and then ideally being shared with those that need it the most. I know you're in, if I recall correctly, you're actually in Vancouver, Canada. Is that correct? Right. And so you have an entirely different health system here than we do in the United States, where, you know, you might have seen TV reports where, you know, hospitals are very afraid of running short on masks and everything else. And now we've got fake sites spinning up. They may try to order from in desperation. I think that's a huge problem.
Oh, big time. I spent 12 years in the UK, so I've experience with the NHS. Right. I spent 7 years in Silicon Valley, so I've got experience with the US healthcare system. And now, yeah, I've been in Vancouver, BC for the past year, and so I'm getting to see what it's like here. And yeah, it's just a horrible situation. What I just cannot understand, cannot fathom how these bad actors are just going after, we know they go after the most vulnerable. But imagine going after the most vulnerable hospitals at a time like this.
Yeah.
And they're going after them with ransomware attacks. And as we know in the security world, the vast majority of cyber attacks start with phishing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd like people to get out of this interview, you know, tips that you and I come up with in the conversation and banter. But, you know, if people just remembered one thing, end users just remembered one thing, I would really love it. And that is not to rely on HTTPS or the browser padlock for trust or identity information.
Yes.
So always look to make sure the website has HTTPS to make sure it's encrypted. Make sure your connection is private. But you know, that could be a private connection to the devil.
Yes.
Because over 93% of all new phishing websites start with HTTPS. So I urge people to not look at that for trust and instead look for other indicators of trust. And I believe, you know, if that's the only thing people walk away with from an end user perspective, I think fewer people will fall for a phishing scam.
Yeah,
because everybody relies on the padlock.
Yes, and I think that's a very, very important point to make. You know, just coming from my side of cybersecurity as well, when we're working with clients, one of those things where we're very easily able to, let's say, download test infections, like zero-day infections, into a network for like a cybersecurity assessment is when their defensive technology can't actually decrypt that green lock. It can't decrypt SSL or that HTTPS to inspect the traffic. And as we know, there's a lot of cyber criminals, as you said, are going to spin up these websites, enable them with these certificates to have that green lock, to give that people that sense of security. And by virtue of it, you think you're in a safe site in the same way you'd go to your bank. And I think that's a very important point. I mean, I would also add to that I think we need to have some common sense. You know, if somebody is offering you a whole bunch of N95 masks for $1 each or something on their website, it's probably not true. You know, you can find legitimate sources, you know, for a lot of these things. But having, on top of that, having a good spam filter or a good web filter, I think, is really going to help in this situation. But because we've seen this explosion, it's very difficult to trust those things to keep up as quickly as we are seeing new domains identified. And there are a lot of good technologies out there, which is why I think the COVID-19 Cyber Threat Coalition is gathering all of this intelligence to help reinforce all of that in the world.
Yep, as the saying goes, hackers don't break in, they log in.
Yeah.
Because as we know, it's easier to compromise a person, it's easier to compromise the human interaction than it is to try and compromise a computer system. It's more effective, it's cheaper, it's faster, it's easier. And you know, if there was a couple of other tips I would throw out there very, very quickly, if you don't mind, Nick, it would be
Please.
Let's not assume anymore. We're living in a new world now. let's not assume that all phishing emails have bad grammar and typos and bad English. Right. They right. don't, especially targeted attacks. And most bulk attacks also, most bulk scams have very well formatted emails, perfect English, good grammar, good spelling. So don't just look for that. And then also the sender, it's easy to make it look like it comes from a specific brand or a colleague. And then hovering over links also doesn't necessarily work by itself because the link can redirect many times and you don't get to see where you're actually going to really end up. So don't look at the padlock for trust. Don't assume it's going to be bad spelling mistakes. Hovering over the link doesn't help. And checking the sender doesn't always help either. So it's kind of just, there are little tips to make people a little bit more aware.
Yes, I would completely agree. And you know, the way I look at it is through the five laws of cybersecurity, which was kind of something that I enjoyed writing. And that is, if there's a vulnerability, if there's a vulnerability, it will be exploited. Everything is vulnerable in some way. Humans trust even when they shouldn't, which I think is really what you're talking about here. And with innovation comes opportunity for exploitation. So as we develop that innovation, the hackers are going to innovate just alongside with us. And finally, when in doubt, see law number one. If there's a vulnerability, it's going to be exploited. Use your eyeballs. You know, figure that out. I think it's a very important message. And I just have to say on an aside, and I don't know if this has been your experience as well, but it has been overwhelmingly amazing to see 3,000 plus cybersecurity professionals volunteer their time around the world, you know, to join us, to be that line in the sand, to protect the hospitals and other critical infrastructure from those that would attack us, you know, especially in a time of crisis. There's no honor among thieves, you know.
And not expecting anything in return either. You know, this community is putting in their experience and their expertise, but they're also donating, you know, technology.
Yes.
And then, as you know, we have a lot of companies that are giving us free licenses to be able to use email platforms, hosting providers, website design, threat intelligence systems.
Oh yeah.
And I don't want to mention any names in particular because I'll forget about some other people that should be mentioned. But 3,000 people coming together, putting in a lot of time and effort to create this central hub, this central repository, central educational system to combat COVID-19. And this is not even something that we've scheduled for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, have we? I mean, we're looking at least a year's project from here out. So it's not something that's gonna go away anytime soon.
Right, right. And as the world continues to battle this pandemic globally, I mean, we're gonna see cyber threat around the globe. And I think that's something that, you know, it's been very heartwarming to see that we can fight back, that these hospitals are not an island unto themselves, that there is support out there, you know, from the COVID-19 Cyber Threat Coalition and our various partners that are supporting us. And with that, unfortunately, we've got to wrap up the time here. But Paul, thank you very much for your time. I think your backstory is absolutely fascinating, you know, and it's been a real pleasure working with you and collaborating with you as well as it has everybody else, you know, in the coalition. And if people want to learn more about you or follow you or learn more about MetaCert, your company, where can they find you?
MetaCert.com.
MetaCert.com.
One address.
Fair enough. That's easy. And if you want to know more about the cyber threat, the COVID-19 Cyber Threat Coalition, you can find us at cyberthreatcoalition.org, where you can sign up, you know, get our intelligence feeds, especially if you're a hospital or critical infrastructure. And with that, Paul, any last words for us?
Stay safe, stay humble, be compassionate.
There you go. Well, Paul Walsh, again, thank you very much for your time. And everybody, I hope you enjoyed this interview with Paul, and we'll see you next time. Take care.
Thanks, Nick.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show with Nick Espinoza. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Ruddenberg. Her email is ursula@pacifica.org. Again, that's ursula@pacifica.org. Again, I'm Nick Espinoza here in Chicago. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
Edition of Jazz Lives, Slant Jazz in the Afternoon. Bob Riddle with you, and we're going to start this special edition by jumping right in with McCoy